My castaway this week is a writer and an academic. His most famous book, The Name of the Rose, was made into a successful film starring Sean Connery. The author, however, is hardly a populist. For the last 25 years, he's been professor of semiotics at Bologna University, and his output was mainly academic before he turned to novel writing at the age of nearly 50. He's written two other fictional works, Foucault's Pendulum and, most recently, The Island of the Day Before. These and his journalistic writings in his native Italy have earned him the title of the most famous intellectual in the world. He is Umberto Eco. It's an extravagant title, Umberto, the world's most famous intellectual. Do you like it? Is it a title you enjoy?
I didn't invent it.
But do you like it? And do you enjoy being called such a thing?
Not particularly, because fame doesn't mean merit.
But do you enjoy your fame?
If you mean that I enjoy to be read all over the world, yes. Otherwise, why one should write? If you mean to be recognized as something, no, I don't. I would prefer to have a more private life. But in a sense, my books are my children. So I have to work for my books. And if I have to pay a certain price in losing my privacy, that is done for my books.
But also, I know you've written in one of your newspaper columns, you wrote once about how many hours a day you had left for your own things,
yes.
Conversation, well, shopping or sex. I mean, I think it came down to about an hour a day, which is
yes,
it's a heavy price.
Yes, fortunately I made my two kids before, so.
But is it true that after the success of The Name of the Rose, you actually went back into academic life and you said, look, can we not talk about it again? Can it not be mentioned?
I succeeded in it. In my university, nobody mentions my novels. There is a sort of silent agreement. Probably most of them read my novels and I'm happy of them.
But I'm sure they want to ask you about your novels. They want to be helped in their interpretation of
them.
They
don't.
They're very careful with Professor Eco, are they, at Bologna University? They know how to treat him. We offer you a kind of escape here, but I'm afraid it's only an imaginary one, because we send you to a desert island. I presume, from everything you said, you really would rather like the idea.
But now, having written a book about a desert island, I feel at home.
Tell me about your music. Tell me the first record that you'd play when you got there.
I want to start with As Time Goes By, a song by Dooley Wilson in Casablanca. And one of them that when watching Casablanca are able to anticipate every line.
You must remember this, a kiss is just a kiss, a sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
As Time Goes By from Casablanca, sung by Dooley Wilson. Umberto Eco, The Name of the Rose has sold 15 million copies, I think, worldwide. It's been translated into 32 languages. It's been incredibly successful. Many people have tried to explain why it's been so successful. What's your explanation?
There are at least 15 million upon 5 billion people in the world that are tired by easy messages. Everything is made too easy. Computers, TV, radio. They want something challenging.
Was it a sort of test for yourself? Did you just sit down one day and think, I've written 20 academic tomes. I'm sure I could write a bestseller. Let's have a go.
A friend of mine who worked for a weekly magazine came to me and said, I got an idea to ask various people in politics, in academia, and so on, to write a short criminal story and to publish one per week in our magazine. And they said, No, I have no time. I think I cannot write stories because I am unable to write dialogues. And then I suddenly say, if I had to write a detection story, it would take place in a medieval monastery and it would be 500 pages long. And she said, no, it's not what I am looking for. Stop. I went home and I said, why not?
Hmm. But it is a difficult novel, as you've said. It does require a lot of work on the part of the reader, and that's not least because a lot of your academic work is reflected in it, semiotics being your subject. Are you saying that you couldn't have written a novel for pure entertainment?
It entertained me, and I think that the readers smell that. It's the same as my relationship with dogs. Even when I was a kid, they were telling me, no, beware of that dog because it's very bad and ferocious. And I had no fear. I went there and the dog understood that I loved him. And so he was very, very friendly with me. The readers are like dogs. They understand that you felt at your ease in writing this book and you enjoyed it. They take part in your enjoyment.
Have you felt as much at ease since writing novels?
Yes, yes, yes. To write a novel for me is a great secret pleasure. That's why they last so long, 8 years and 6 years. I wouldn't like to finish them. Because the real enjoyment is to write them. Once they are finished, they belong to somebody else, and I feel orphan.
And you lose your secret life.
Yes, that's...
Tell me about record number two.
Well, as number two, something more serious according to the official standards. The first movement of Chopin's Piano Sonata number 2 in B-flat, opus 35.
Why do you like it?
It was probably the first classic composition I heard. It was immediately after the war. I was 16. At the time, in my native city, Alessandria, there were no concert halls. And so, by chance, maybe, I discovered that the radio was broadcasting classical music. That was the door I entered to live in the musical universe.
Of Chopin's Piano Sonata number 2 in B-flat minor, opus 35, played by Ivo Pogorelich. Let's talk about the circumstances of your childhood, your home and your parents and so on. I gather your parents worked for a company that made iron bathtubs, is that right?
Yeah, more or less. It was a petit bourgeoisie family, normal childhood, with two experiences that were in any case unique. First, to live under a dictatorship. To be raised in the worship of war and heroism. That's why I became a pacifist.
You would have been what? You were born in 32, so you
32,
were
so
you were a boy during the war.
All my education was so. And then the war.
Yeah.
And not so much the war in the city with the first bombing before we escaped. My father remained to work in the city and we escaped in the countryside. We had an uncle and an aunt living there. But it was the wrong choice because that was the center of the partisan war. So I spent my years between 11 and 13 with people shooting around.
Well, this was the partisans, was it?
Partisan and fascist.
Yes.
But it was guerrilla.
I read that you were a member of the Mussolini Youth Movement, were you?
As everybody, mandatorily, in Italy.
What did that entail? What did you have to do?
It meant that every Saturday we were put in uniform and we marched. Pre-military.
Did you enjoy it?
But at that age, yes. To sing an anthem or to march and to have a uniform seems... In my early years, I wanted to become a soldier until 43. Then the war became something very serious. Then I discovered at the fall of fascism that there was something else around. I smelled... the smell of freedom and of democracy.
Of course, your parents, they were I think you've written, they were the first generation to wear a hat and tie. They were kind of working class, made good. Obviously, yes. None of them had ever been to university.
Yes, my parents were the first generation of their kind to have a tie and a hat. And not, they were white and not blue collars.
And were they aware that the young Umberto had brains?
I was a successful boy. In the school, I was one of the good ones, and then in my adolescence, I organized the shows and things. So I was already a public figure in my small environment.
But did they enjoy it? Did they enjoy having this bright boy, or did it worry them a bit, perhaps?
No, they enjoyed. So I have only half a remorse in my life, because my father, when I was then 18. Was not so happy that I made the philosophy at the university. The ideal of middle bourgeois there was to have a lawyer in the family. He died maybe too early, in 65, and so he didn't know that I had an acceptable career. But when my second book was published, The Open Work, it was reviewed on the main newspaper of Italy by an important, it was the poet Eugenio Montale, and he was very proud. And I think that for him it was enough to understand that I was doing well.
Record number 3.
Something from the Drei Groschen Oper, the Three Penny Opera, text by Bertolt Brecht, okay, but music of Kurt Weill, that I consider one of the greatest contemporary composers.
Da ist nun einer schon, der Satan selber, der Metzger und alle andern Kälber, der frechste Hund, der schlimmste Hurentreiber, wer kocht ihn ab, der alle abkocht, Weiber. Das fragt nicht, ob will, ist bereit, das ist die sexuelle Hörigkeit.
Uta Lemper singing Die Ballade von der sexuellen Hörigkeit from Kurt Weill's Throppany Opera. You said, Umberto Eco, that you always intended to be an academic, and yet immediately after leaving Turin University, you joined RAI, the Italy's state-owned television. Why did you do that? I mean, you made programmes.
No, I had the idea that to start an academic life, I had to be a wealthy person at the time, and I wasn't. So I had to find a job.
You needed the money, basically. I mean, you couldn't afford to be an academic.
And I wanted to be independent also, and so I went to Milano, and I started those 3-4 years of TV experience. At that time, the radio and TV building was the crossroad of... I met there Stravinsky, Bertolt Brecht. I met my friend musicians Luciano Berio, Pierre Boulez, Stockhausen, and I entered the world of Neue Musik. I met actors and actresses, and even young actresses. It was an exciting an exciting moment.
But eventually, I think you spent about 5 years in television, didn't you?
4.5 years, more or less.
And then you diversified into publishing, into this academic life that you yearned for, and into journalism, which is roughly what you still do, really, isn't it, all three. But tell me more about the journalism, because it's through the newspaper columns, certainly in the beginning, that you made your name in Italy. Opinion pieces you've written.
Yes, opinion pieces. Critique de mœurs in French, analysis
of manners,
everyday
society.
Behavior of society.
But you've also
some mass media.
But you've also written some very light-hearted pieces. I mean, I've read pieces of yours about how to use your electric nose hair cutter or how to deal with a taxi driver. But why do you need to do it? Your time is so valuable, you say. Why do you want to write these fairly superficial opinion pieces?
This is an interesting question. I wouldn't say very superficial. Sometime in a short article you can get also an interesting idea. Second is a way to be in touch with readership.
Are you saying that it's the communication with people that's important to you? That you don't feel that you should keep yourself as an academic apart?
Yes, it is a way to not to stay in an ivory tower.
Hmm. Is it more than that? Is it almost, do you feel, a duty of an academic to communicate?
Yes, there are a lot of people who work at the university and they don't like to teach. I like to teach. If I make an effort to understand something, immediately after I feel the impulse to tell somebody else what I learned. Otherwise, there is no pleasure in learning. So I think this is the real impulse.
Record number four.
Bach's Goldberg Variations. I am a modest record player and I play Bach frequently and I love it. The Goldberg Variations are a perfect merging of musical complexity and of complete friendliness for the listener. You can abandon yourself and follow them without any effort.
Goldberg Variations number 22, played by Andrei Gavrilov. So you're now professor of semiotics at Bologna University, a chair which was created for you and by you, as it were. Semiotics, I read, is the study of the signs and symbols by which we communicate. What does that include? What kinds of signs beyond the written word and art?
We communicate through gestures. Not only the deaf-mute, but even common people communicate by gestures. We communicate by movement of our face. We communicate through our architecture, through objects.
Through our clothes.
Clothes, obviously.
So it's everything. Everything is included.
With everything. And obviously this is black and clear and maybe trivial. The problem is there a unified approach that can explain with the same intellectual instruments, those various ways of communicating.
Your lectures, I understand, are very popular.
My lectures at the university are very well attended, but not very popular. They are very, very difficult.
Well, as far as I understand it, and I've never attended one, you can analyse an advert for Coca-Cola 1 minute or a pair of blue jeans, and at the same time you can discuss Donatello's David.
I did it in my youth. Now there is a lot of young people doing it better than me.
But just to try and get a basic understanding of what you're saying is that all of these things deserve analysis, that when we are presented with a pile of bricks in an art gallery or a woman asleep in a glass box, that this is truly deserving of the same analysis as what we would consider to be a great work of art.
This doesn't mean that they are the same thing. This means that they must and can be seriously analyzed in the same way. You have the intellectual duty to analyze in the same way a poem by Homer and the words of a very popular song. This doesn't mean that they are the same thing. On the contrary, I think that a good analyst can prove why Homer is more important or greater or not than a popular song.
So are you saying, is semiotics as simple as to say, approach everything with an open mind?
No. To approach everything is used in order to communicate. I can approach with an open mind chemistry or something. That is a form of contemporary philosophy. And I don't think that it can be dealt with so easily in a short conversation. I'm used to say that since I have written many books on that, if I was able to tell it in few words, I would have sent a telegram instead of writing all those books.
Next record.
In the early 70s, I went for the first time in Buenos Aires, and I discovered the real tango. And you know that the great hero of tango is Gardel, who died, I don't remember, in the 30s, and still in Argentina is worshipped. And I would try Por una cabeza, one of the great tangos sung by Gardel.
Por una cabeza, borra la tristeza, calma la amargura. Por una cabeza, y ella me olvida. ¿Qué importa perderme mil veces la vida? ¿Para qué vivir?
Carlos Gardel singing the tango Por una cabeza. Umberto Eco, Salman Rushdie, as I'm sure you know, condemned your second novel, Foucault's Pendulum, as higher bullshit. But it wasn't a total insult, as I read it. He reckoned he knew that you were writing bullshit, that you were playing with us, that you were inventing junk fiction for fun.
We met in Paris because I was a member of the Académie Universelle de Culture in Paris, and I introduced myself saying, I am the bullshit. and we became good friends.
Okay. But did you tell him that that was not true, or would you admit that it is true?
I think that a gentleman must never argue with his critics. I think that an author that argues with his critics is vulgar and impolite. When you make so-called creative writing, poems and novels, if you write a philosophical book, on the contrary, you have the right and the duty to defend it and to argue about it, because if you write a philosophical book and somebody makes a given criticism of it, you are adding rational arguments to support your thesis. Sure. It is like if you were writing additional pages of your book. With a novel, you cannot write additional pages of your book. So you have not the right to do this.
But nevertheless, you must care what people think about it and what they say about it. Don't you have a kind of desire to defend it?
That's a different matter. Everybody likes to be loved. But that's a different matter.
Well, so why didn't you tell Salman Rushdie that?
When you write a book, you know that you abandon your message in a bottle, and somebody can like it, somebody can dislike, and you cannot go around the world to kill those who don't like your book. Okay.
But as you say, in an ideal world, your book would be liked. But you also think that we, the readers, should work quite hard. You said that earlier on. You do, nevertheless, make it quite difficult for us. I mean, you opened up Foucault's Pendulum with a huge unattributed quotation in Hebrew that, you know, was very difficult to clamber past.
That was done on purpose. That's the way I like to write. I like to involve my reader in a sort of challenge.
But a lot of people perhaps are intimidated by that challenge. I mean, perhaps it takes someone of the stature of Salman Rushdie to have the kind of literary confidence to call your bluff, actually, and say, isn't this a load of bullshit?
Okay, it's very right.
Don't you want to defend it?
I cannot. Moreover, consider that today Balzac or Dickens or Stendhal or Tolstoy cannot defend themselves. They are dead. So you have to behave as you were dead.
Behave as if you were dead?
Yes, to disappear. Behind your work, Joyce said, as the god of the creation curing his fingernails.
Tell me about your sixth record.
The author is Jacob van Eyck, a Flemish Dutch flutist of the Cathedral of Utrecht, born at the end of the 16th century, but working practically in the 17th century, who produced a three-volume corpus, the Flutenlusthof, which is a masterpiece of the flute music. And I play them, and they are for C record. And it has become one of the characters of my new novel, because my protagonist, Roberto della Grive, at a certain point meets in a Dutch cathedral a blind flutist, and the two ships of my novel are called Daphne and Amaryllis, and Daphne and Amaryllis are the two pieces by van Eyck I like more. So I would like to listen to the first part of Daphne.
Jacob van Eyck's Daphne, the most beautiful maiden, played by Frans Bruggen. This third novel, The Island of the Day Before, it's something of a Robinson Crusoe story. Your hero...
Well, put upside down, or...
Quite, because he's on the boat, on Daphne.
He's shipwrecked, marooned on the boat, not on the island.
And he can't get to the island.
Reached,
no. Quite, because he can't swim.
He can swim.
Can you swim? You can, I take it.
Yes, but yeah. It took me a lot of time to try to not to swim in order to imagine his movements. I found a late 17th century book that taught how to swim, and since this art was practically unknown at that time, the instructions it gives are crazy. So I followed those instructions and they sucked down.
Where do you write in the main? I read that you have a private chapel in the hills above Rimini, and you sit in your chapel.
Well, it was an old chapel that now became my study, yes.
And do you need silence, or do you play this music that you love so much while you write?
It depends. Sometimes I need a musical background. Sometimes not. Sometimes you write in a hotel room on the train. Sometimes you are peacefully sitting in your studio and you don't write.
Tell me about record number 7.
The second movement of Beethoven's Symphony number 7. I'm particularly fond of that because in those my young years, I remember that one evening at the Conservatory of Torino, I didn't find any place, so I was obliged to sit up there on a step. I didn't see the orchestra. I was alone, so maybe prepared to muse. And at the second movement, in a way, I cried. And it reminds me that intense musical experience.
Thank you.
part of the second movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 7, played by the Philharmonia Orchestra of La Scala, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. Are you a survivor, Umberto Eco? Will you manage to keep yourself alive on this island?
I hope it is not an Antarctic island, but a South Seas island with coconuts and easy fish to fish.
But would you not perhaps, you know, wither away for lack of company? You're obviously gregarious. You obviously, as you said, like to communicate.
I like solitude. I like very much to be alone. Maybe because my life obliges me so frequently to interact with other people, but I am looking more and more for moments of solitude. So perhaps I could stand it.
What do you think you'd fear most?
As anybody else is suffering, and probably even the island, I got some disease without aspirin and without anything else. Probably it would be a bad moment, but I try to interpret herbs and weeds to see if I rediscover the great wisdom.
But eventually you try to escape, would you?
Since I like very much to swim and even to float, For if possible, 4 hours thinking that would be an ideal situation, and it would be free. A solitude can be a form of freedom.
Last record.
Well, this is the part of the final act of Mozart's Don Giovanni when the commander arrives. All the arias of Don Giovanni became so popular because they are easy to sing. This one cannot. The melodical line is so difficult that you can listen at it for years and never be... except you are a professional and you sing it professionally. It is of such a difficulty, he wants to render this sudden apparition of death, of the infernal power, something that escapes human comprehension, and that it escapes also the human musical comprehension. So I think it's a terrible passage. It makes me thrill every time I hear it.
Part of the final act of Mozart's Don Giovanni with Robert Hull, Laszlo Polgár, Thomas Hampson and the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam, conducted by Nicolas Arnoncourt. If we decided that you could only take one of those 8 records, Umberto Eco, which one would it be?
Probably the one that can last indefinitely in Goldberg's Variation.
And already waiting for you are the complete works of Shakespeare. They're already on your island, and the Bible is there too. What single book in addition would you like?
The New York phone book.
Why?
It contains all the names of the world, and there you can imagine an infinite series of stories with infinite characters, and it's the only way to be active on that island. Every other book could be finished in a while. That is a sort of immense hypertext.
And then beyond that, you're allowed one luxury, and the luxury can't be of any practical use at all.
Can I have a laptop, a computer?
Yes.
What?
I thought you disapproved of computers.
No, but with the phone book to give me inspiration and the computer, I can write stories when I don't swim. And that would be a way to stand the solitude for a long time.
And you're happy, therefore, to leave behind the cigarettes, are you? Despite the pile
that
in the ashtray.
That would be the chance, this shipwreck, to quit smoking.
Umberto Eco, I wish you luck. Thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.